This show is brought to you by The Makery, the podcast network for makers.
Are you ready?
Yes, I am.
Guys, welcome to the Full Blast Podcast. I'm Jeff Fader, and I'm here in Johnstown, PA with Pat Quinn, live. Well, not really live, but in the Center for Mental Arts, Johnstown, PA, for another episode of Great Question with Pat Quinn. Which episode is this?
Six.
All right, guys, before we get into it, let me take care of a little of the business. Number one, I want to thank my friends at Broadbeck Ironworks, makers of the 2x72 grinder. This grinder is sick and is perfect for you. It's got great attachments. It's got all the things that you're going to need to move metal. So if you go to broadbeckironworks.com, put in the promo code KNIFETALK10, you're going to get 10% off everything. I want to thank my friends at Evenheat, manufacturers of the finest heat treat ovens available. To get your next oven, go to evenheat-kiln.com, get yourself involved with the tap control, get yourself involved with the solid state drive. If you're trying to get specific temperatures, don't play. You're playing, you're gonna have a problem. So go to evenheat-kiln.com. We're in the office of Pat Quinn, and we're also doing paperwork. So there's going to be a little bit of that too. Next are my friends at Maritime Knife Supply. That's maritimeknifesupply.com for all your knife making needs, belts, abrasives, steels, kilns, forges, presses, heat treating ovens, anvils, and everything else you need to get started or resupplied. They have a growing range and a growing selection of steels, and I would highly suggest you get that 1080 hex bar. If you're trying to make some integral bolsters, it's definitely good for you. So go to maritimeknifesupply.com. And if you see something that he doesn't have, especially if you're in Canada, that you want, reach out to him. He's a facilitator. He'll get you squared away. So maritimeknifesupply.com. Next are my friends at Stable Rail Knife Finishing Vice. That's Trojan Horse Forge. That's Sam and Jeff. They make beautiful vices built in the heart of Texas to get your handles in your knife making to a whole new level. Go check out what they got going on, and highly suggest checking out that Sable Rail Knife Finishing Vice. And if you go to TrojanHorseForge.com, you can put in the promo code FULLBLAST10 for 10% off all your vices, your T4 Sentinel Oil, handle press attachment, all that. I really appreciate the guys over at Trojan Horse Forge, and thank you so much to Jeff and Sam. Next are my friends at Baker Forge and Tool. That's BakerForge.com for all your exotic steel needs. They have really beautiful stuff. I've been fooling around with their exotic steels, their copper mascus and their copper mise and all their clad steels. And once again, this should not be intimidating stuff. If you are a stock removal guy and you want to kind of up your game, this stuff is great. And when you're done putting it together and making the knife, you gotta make sure people can see all the beautiful steel with the copper shims and the liners and all that stuff. You gotta use that gator piss. That's right, ladies and gentlemen, gator piss. This stuff is really great etching, and it's pre-mixed, and it's all their own. Baker Forge has figured out a really great etching combination recipe, and it's gator piss, and I've been using it for everything. I've been using it for all the Baker Forge stuff, regular Damascus, anything outside of the Baker Forge world stuff works, and it's definitely worth getting. And if you go to Texas Farrier Supply, they can give it to you with a discount. If you use the discount code KNIFETALK10, you're going to get 10% off everything over at Texas Farrier Supply, another great company that does knife making supplies, blacksmithing supplies, bladesmithing supplies, farrier stuff. So definitely check out what's going on over at Texas Farrier Supply. And by all means, give Baker Forge a shot. They do great content, and they're really good dudes. So definitely check out my boys over at Baker Forge. And if you go to Baker Forge, you can put in the promo code FULLBLAST, and you're going to get 10% off. All these deals, all these links, all of them are in the show notes where you're listening to this, so you don't have to kind of try to remember. Just go back here, and it'll all explain itself. I want to thank my friends at Total Boat. That's TotalBoat.com, makers of adhesive paints, primers, polishing compounds. They started out for boaters and DIYers, and now they work with a lot of makers. So if you are in the mood to make a river table or hybrid handle material or any of that stuff, or if you're just looking for a new epoxy that really works really well, I really, really, really like their two-part epoxy. I've been using it for about 2 years now, and I'm really happy with the results. They also have dyes. They also have flex if you want to make if you want to make hybrid handle material with the cloudy flex of color. They have all that stuff, and it's specially designed for the use of the Total Boat stuff. So go to totalboat.com/fullblast. There's a link in the show notes, and it will give you the direct link to get a discount, and it'll give me some street cred. So go to totalboat.com/fullblast. Just got a load of G.L. Hansen & Sons G-Carta. And I can't thank the guys over G.L. Hansen & Sons enough. Greg has been amazing, and he sent me this great stuff, and you're asking me, what's G-Carta? Imagine, like, you have, it's like linen or canvas micarta, and then it's different colors, and it's put in a different pattern, and then they make like a loaf of it, and they put in epoxy and heat. And I'm not 100% sure how he does it, but then what they'll do is once it's set, they'll cut slabs of it, and it's like this beautiful, like it's brain coral. It's like there's tie dye and all these different colors, and there's like, it's really, really great stuff. So if you go to gcarta.bigcartel.com, you can get yourself some of that. I'm starting to get messages from customers who are interested in just getting figuring out what G-Carta we have. So definitely go check out gcarta.bigcartel.com and check it out. Why not? And I want to really, really, really thank my friends at Tormek. I had the best time in Sweden, and it's a first-class company. If you go to the last episode at Tormek, we had a great conversation about the history of the company. It's a maker's company. It's a company developed by people who are trying to solve a problem. And now they're one of the biggest knife sharpening machine companies in the world. 40 countries are shipping them Tormek to, and it's really, really great. If you're a knife maker, or we just learned there, if you're a woodworker, if you're trying to keep your chisel sharp, Tormek is for you. It really is awesome, and I am really, really super duper appreciative of all my friends over at Tormek. We're going to get involved with them a little bit more, and maybe we'll have some other people on from Tormek. They're an outstanding organization, and they've just, I can't say enough nice things about how they treated me and my wife, and the products are awesome. So go to Tormek.com or at Tormek_sharpening on Instagram, and get involved. They're very involved with social media, and if you're in the sharpening game, Tormek might be for you, so definitely check it out. Now, we're here in Johnstown, PA. We're in the office of the director of the Center for Metal Arts, Patrick Quinn. We are on episode 6, I think. I think it might be more, frankly, but we'll find out. Of Great Question with Pat Quinn, where we answer your forging questions. Pat, it's great to see your face.
Nice to see you too, Jeff.
So what's going on?
A lot, man. Getting ready mainly for the 2-week workshop in the Octagon.
Every time I come down here, I'm always surprised at how much... I come here maybe every 6 months, or maybe 5 months, 6 months. I'm always surprised at how much extra work you get done. That's the most amazing thing. And what you've been working on recently is this new gigantic forge. Could you talk about what's going on with this giant forge?
Yeah. So this time around, the main goal here was to, well, I guess a goal that I had sort of always been working towards, but felt like this is the year it's gonna happen. Two hammers running at the same time, two teams, two furnaces, all that stuff. So everything was in place to really, achieve that, or actually, I don't know if it's achieved yet, but give it a shot. And the last piece of the puzzle was the extra furnace. And because there's a really nice community around here, full of supportive people, and I'd been introduced to some folks who work in industrial furnace building out of Pittsburgh, and they had come to the shop for a tour and a visit, and I sort of let them know what I was interested in building, and they've been incredibly helpful building that furnace with the refractory material, the design, the construction, all that kind of stuff. And then, of course, you know, my trusted team of helpers here, Joe, Greg, Andy, you know, folks like that. We tackled the burners, the propane plumbing, source the blower, plumbed the air, you know, all that kind of stuff. Had the first fire 2 days ago in it without doors. I just bricked up the front and back door just to see if, you know, the burners were going to perform the way I was hoping, if I had enough air, tried to tune the air to fuel mixture, all that kind of stuff. And it ripped. It was really awesome. So I'm super pumped.
What I'm amazed at is how, I mean, you've never really, have you built forges before?
I've never built a forge before. This is my first one.
And what are some of the, like, I mean, this thing is huge. I mean, it probably weighs, I mean, what's the inside dimension of it around?
36 long, 28 wide, and 22 tall.
That's huge.
Yeah, well, I mean, we have big hammers, right?
Yeah, you have big hammers with big material. What, I mean, you obviously you had help in terms of designing what it needed to be, but I mean, I've been recently, we've been talking in the last couple of days, and you've been saying, like, look, we're just swinging at the pitches that come over the plate. How do you go about, did you have a lot of help in regards to the refractory? Because when I came in here, you had got a shipment for a refractory, and it was all sheets of refractory compressed together you said that the refractory is compressed and then it's held together and it's like under pressure. And how do you go about starting from the first forge you're making is this incredible monster?
Well, you have to have the help, right? And I never wanted to be a furnace builder, to be quite honest, nor do I still want to be either a furnace builder. It's not like something I take a lot of pleasure in or anything. It's necessary for the kind of position that I'm in the restoration work that we're doing in the Octagon. So, you know, when I met the furnace builders from Pittsburgh, you know, and I showed him what I was interested in. I like the old furnace that we run size wise, but it was just like a little too tight to fit like 2 6-inch square bars in there. So basically they asked me what my ideal interior dimension was, which I said, you know, a little bit bigger than the one we currently have, but mainly I really wanted a bigger doorway, because that was becoming part of the problem with the old furnace. Was the door, it was like a choke point before you got into the furnace. So the furnace had a lot more volume in it than I felt like the door allowed you to put in it. So that was a big concern of mine moving forward when I was thinking about a new furnace in the Octagon. And so what they did was once I told them what my ideal interior dimensions were, they designed the furnace so that I didn't have to cut any bricks.
Right.
So we went to like the nearest dimension we could get given the brick dimension. So I didn't have to do a ton of like brick cutting and get a brick saw and all that kind of stuff, which I'll have to get eventually. But, and then so the furnace really is like inspired by the old furnaces in the shop. It's almost exactly the same sort of construction with the same materials. And the only difference is the roof and the doors are incredibly modern, and they're these like really top-notch ceramic fiber modules. And this is what you were talking about, but this is like real industry standard kind of stuff from a lot of the industrial forges I've been to visit. And so it's like, it's better than KO wool, but it comes like compressed in a way that it has a fastener system so that you can install it really easily to a fabricated structure. And it's incredibly reflective, and the refractory is really good. So the roof is that, and the doors are that. And the best part about this construction, in my mind, is the roof lifts on and off, and it's literally just resting on there. There's no fastener at all.
So it's just the weight.
Just the weight. So if it, you know, if I ever need to do some masonry work, brick work, you know, you just drive a fork truck over there, or actually you just use the crane. You can lift the roof right off, no problem, and do any kind of brick work you want, and the roof goes back on.
Was that intentional? I mean, but back in the day, did they want to make these forges so they were easy to maintain?
No, that was not. Back in the day, there were like the old forge we use, it has a brick arch ceiling. And so there, you know, like a mason built that forge.
Right.
And there was, you know, 8 of them in the octagon alone. And so, you know, they would get used and abused, and then they'd come in and have to get fixed as needed. But Bethlehem Steel had, you know, they had a masonry department and a refractory department, and it was nothing for a bricklayer to come in there, tear a forge apart and redo the bricks and stuff like that. I didn't want to really get involved in that, and the technology of furnace building has changed a lot, and so that's why I opted, under the guidance of these furnace builders that have helped me, to go for a modern roof and a modern door, because they're easy to work on, they're easy to replace, and they're much more reflect the heat a lot faster than a brick does.
That's the one thing that it's amazing to me is how, is there so much repair that needs to be done with all this stuff? And I just wonder, back in the day, how much things needed to be repaired, but having a mason on, you know, somebody who obviously knows how to repair a furnace quickly, and they have so many back there. I'm sure that there was never any moments where they had to shut everything down because one furnace wasn't ready to go.
No, I don't think so. And I think, I mean, it depends on the furnace, because in the double arch room, there's only 2 furnaces, and I've got a work order, an old work order in my historic archive collection of from the blacksmith shop to the refractory department for furnace repair on one of those. And if you only have 2, then you might, you know, your production might go down while the furnace gets repaired. But also, even like in steel mills and stuff like that, even modern steel mills, when you have, you know, ladle cars and all that kind of stuff that are actually brick, you know, they have to, you have to shut down every once in a while to do the refractory repair. But I can't really speak to this, but, you know, you've got to just budget that time down into your annual whatever.
This makes me wonder, for the listeners especially, if you were starting out and if somebody came up to you and said, hey, listen, I'm starting out, I've taken on some classes, I'm really interested in starting a home forge, I want to get a gas forge, what would you, you don't have to say names of companies, what would you look for in a gas forge? For a person starting out,
plug and play.
But like, I know that there are people who like 3-burner forges and single burner forges and ribbon forges and all this stuff. If you were to start off from scratch, or let's say you were just to open up a tiny little spot, you know, like a little tiny spot for Pat Quinn, you simple
to not, have fun.
Yeah, to have fun. What kind of forge would you look for? What would you look for in a forge?
Who knows, man? But honestly, like I would like, for that scenario you just described, I would say like I would want a Venturi burner.
What is a Venturi burner?
A Venturi burner. See, now you.
I mean, give me the.
No, it's funny. I guess it's, my understanding of it is it it's higher pressure from the tank, and it draws the air, it draws from the atmosphere through the burners rather than from a fan.
Okay, so it's less, it's more fuel. Would that be more fuel rich than something of pumped air?
Well, you can control the amount of air that comes into a Venturi by some sort of sliding gate or screwing valve system or something like that. So you can go fuel rich or you can go air rich with a Venturi, just like you can with a forced air. You just, the air gate is just coming from the atmosphere rather than from a blower.
Okay. That's what I have. Not like those ones with a little fan on the side.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, I don't know. Like, I'm not a furnace expert, so.
Yeah, but you know what you like in a forge.
Well, I'm learning what I like in a forge. But I don't know which one's more fuel efficient yet either. Why I said a Venturi burner for that situation is because you don't have to plug it in.
Right.
And for people just getting started, or they want to like just have some fun, you know, and not overcomplicate things, then, Venturi is kind of nice because you can just hook it up to your tank. You can build some sort of cart where the tank and the forge are on the same thing, move it wherever you need to. You don't have to run extension cords. You know, if the power goes out, you can still forge. It's just kind of nice and convenient, but I don't think it's as dialable, maybe, but I don't really know.
Well, it's just interesting to me because like there are so many options, and that you when people, especially students, and I want to start to get into like the classes and how the class has been going, but when students ask questions, they just, when they say I have a forge, when I think about what I have, I know I have one single burner forge that I built years ago that I love, but it's not powerful enough to do, it doesn't have enough fuel, it doesn't have enough power to do forge welding or anything like that. I have a three burner forge that I like, it's okay, but I don't, it sucks out so much gas, I never really use it for just everyday forging. And so it makes me wonder, it's just like, what would I be looking for? And I guess it would be based on the kind of stuff that I was doing.
Absolutely. And the money you have.
And then the idea of how much you're willing to deal with tanks. I mean, some people can't have gas companies come and fill their tanks up. And frankly, I use the barbecue tanks because I'm 50 and I don't want to schlep 100-pound tanks to my refill guy, you know?
Yeah, definitely. It's all things you have to consider for sure. And, it's worth considering that before or during your introduction or involvement into the craft of foraging, because if you can do it pretty primitively with a really low buy-in, but it is fuel consumption heavy of a craft, not quite as much as like kilns or glass furnaces or something like that, but in order to work, you've got to be burning fuel.
One of the things people ask me when they're especially home users, knife makers and blacksmiths and stuff, is when they're using a forge and they use a small tank, do you know why they get frosted up if it's working too much? Or
I don't know. I can't say for sure why that happens.
Yeah. It's like a volume. I think it might be a volume thing.
It's definitely a volume thing because that, when I was, this whole project that I'm working on in the Octagon has gone through like a ton of stages of development, a lot of testing, hypothesis testing, equipment testing, and then I always want to start with the lowest investment to see if it's going to work, right? So there was occasions where when we first started running the old forge just to see if it was something viable or worth putting time and energy into, I didn't have huge propane tanks outside the shop or natural gas service or anything like that yet. And I would hook it up to a 100-pound propane tank. And, if it's high pressure, which it would have to be if you're a Venturi burner, which I think I did at first time, was I put a bunch of Venturi burners in that forge. And, the tank froze up like almost instantly. Normally it waits till it gets to the bottom or
right,
something, and then it freezes up. But, I didn't have the volume of propane to run as much you know, BTU as I was trying to get, and I was cranking up the pressure, and the tank froze like immediately. And then when the tank freezes, your pressure drops. And so then I, Tim Lucas, he built me these little manifold things so I could like daisy chain 600-pound tanks together just to increase my volume. And then I could burn it, you know, and then all six tanks would freeze, but it wasn't until they were almost empty.
Right.
And so that sort of solved the problem. And so that made me go, well, let's get some big tanks because we need the volume. And but also I don't use a Venturi burner over there. So when I run the furnace, I'm like, you know, 4 PSI.
Okay.
And then shit doesn't freeze that, yeah, much that low.
Hmm. Yeah, the forges are, I mean, I'm in seeing what it was really cool going to over and seeing the forge. And if you go to Full Blast Podcast on Instagram, I'm going to put pictures up of the forge. It's just amazing. And the fact that you've been able to build it yourself. And I know that you're under a lot of pressure to finish it because this coming week, you're starting the forging focus. Tell me about the class that you're going to be using that forge with.
It's not this coming week. It's the next. So I have 1 week of time to finish working before the class starts. But it's that class that we've been talking about a lot, collaborative sculpture, first ever class in the Octagon where students are using and forging on the large scale utility hammers.
That's going to be sick. I was talking to Haley Arbor about the class. She's terrific, and she's one of your interns now, and she's taking the class, and she was trying to explain to me how you have two teams working at the same time. And when she explained that you have two teams and you have the students and you have a supervisor and you have safety has always been such a huge part of your situation, of your whole ethos. You know, part of it is safety. Can you explain how the two teams will be working together in the same place with two different forges and two different utility hammers?
Yeah, you know, for the first time, running this class for the first time, you know, well, it was supposed to be Christoph teaching it, but I had to take over that role for various reasons. So there's some curveballs for sure. Anyway, so it had become clear to me that for the first time, 8 students is the right number because the sculpture that I've designed, it involves lots of forgings where you need to use the crane because the metal's either, well, it's a combination of being incredibly heavy and incredibly long. And I've found in my time working here that you need 5 people at each hammer, including the driver, to work safely and efficiently if you're going to be using the crane. So that's sort of the metric, base metric of which I've made the decision to have 8 students, because I will be driving one of the hammers and Andy Doner will be driving another one of the hammers, and he's sort of got the most experience driving a hammer of anyone besides myself since we've been working on them. So it felt natural for him and I to assume the roles as hammer drivers. And then so we're one person at each hammer and then 4 students at each hammer. So that's the 5, right? So that's why I decided 8 would be a good number of students for this class.
It seems like, I mean, you have 2 giant utility hammers going. You have 2 giant forges going. Will there be like pit crews to make sure that everything's working the way it's working? Or do you guys have to like just kind of get everything squared away so you don't have to need some sort of support system?
There's a lot of support system that's actually in place for this workshop from people who... are really supportive of CMA and have been since it's sort of since I started working there when the shop was in New York. And so I've asked humbly for two people that I trust incredibly to actually be team leaders at each hammer. So besides Andy and myself, I have two people that will help the students. They're not really workshop participants as much as they are student facilitators, sort of a thing, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
At each hammer, because there's so much subtle nuance to opening and closing the forge doors, running the crane up and down, the swing, the tools, being level, being plumb, what do I do now? You know, a lot of these folks, well, none of them have really worked on hammers like this for very long. And we're all learning as we go. And so it felt like a really good situation to have a couple people that I trust that have worked on these hammers more than most people have to be there to help the students be safe and have fun. And that also keeps Andy and I in the driver's seat. It can present a pretty dangerous situation if I lift the ram and then need to jump out of the driver's seat to help the students with the ram engaged. So, you know, that was really a part of that as well. And then, of course, my good friend and longtime CMA supporter, Joe, who's helped with the air systems and all that kind of stuff around here, is going to sort of be here to help as well. And I feel like we haven't really sort of ironed this out, you know, his role specifically, but he's got a really good sense, you know, for the systems, the air systems, the propane, all that kind of stuff. So I feel really comfortable having him here to, if we're going to need to troubleshoot something like that, because, you know, this is the first go at it. So if we run into a problem with the compressor or the burners or something like that, we've got a lot of people to consult. But, you know, I feel real comfortable having Joe here for that too, as well as Joe's worked on the hammers a lot as well. So
what's amazing is just thinking, just listening to you and thinking about it, there's so much, you know, similarities between having a class, even though this class will be working on the same sculpture, you have different groups, and it is kind of it's really cool when you look at how you would take a class at CMA, how you see you have there's six gas forges, and then you have, like, you know, whatever, 10 anvils, and you have different people working on different things at the same time, and you have this, you're constantly scaling up the way a normal class would be. And now you have two, I'm going to say independent, but they're not really independent because you're working on the same thing. You have two groups working in this giant utility hammer building. And it is like a scale up, exponential growth, similar to how you would have multiple students in the regular shop.
Right. I guess, you know, to comment on that really is, like, from my understanding, and I really hesitate to say this because I don't know how to say it, but I think this is the first of its kind, a student workshop. You know, there have been big collaborative sculpture workshops, so that concept is nothing new, but for an educational facility to have hammers this size that are for this purpose and introduce students to them, I don't think that's ever really happened before. And then, like, you know, there's a lot of people here in America, or, you know, other countries in Europe and stuff, that have big hammers and things like that. You know, but this is a different scale, and it's a different process. And it's like, so the whole thing is really new. And that's why I've called upon some people to be a support system, because, you know, nobody really knows what to expect, myself included, because nobody's, I don't think, ever ran a workshop with equipment like this.
Yeah.
So.
Well, that also dovetails into the class you just finished, which was the School is Cool class. The School is Cool workshop, which we actually have questions from some of the students from that. The School is Cool workshop was really cool to, I mean, I say cool again, but it was really interesting to talk to your students and to talk to you, because this was the first time teaching the School is Cool project class. Could you just talk a little bit about that class?
Yeah, that's the one for people interested in teaching, where I created, with the help of my partner Aaron, who has a master's in education, a syllabus and curriculum that really helps guide aspiring educators towards a successful workshop.
What was really cool was talking to, I keep saying cool, I know maybe you put that in my head because the school is cool.
Cool is cool.
I'm cool. So, Maisel, keep going with it. That's something that's for you, Haley. So what was interesting was is hearing the students who had just finished the class, because basically what it was everyone has to come up with an idea to teach a class, and every participant of the class comes up with their own curriculum and then teaches everyone in the class. So for 4 weeks, every participant is coming up with an idea for a class, and then you're kind of workshopping the ideas, and then they have to figure out how to teach the class to the rest of the students, and then they have like a kind of a group critique in regards to if it was successful, the pros, the cons, what could have been better. And it was really an intensive way, an amazing way to try to figure out how to create and run a forging class.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really, really important class. And I'm glad that it was developed. And I was really, really happy to have the help of Aaron to create the syllabus and everything, because this class is way more than just forging. It's curriculum development, it's preparation, it's teaching philosophy, it's artist statement, it's workshop description. We talk a lot about its marketability, teaching in different facilities. How do you adapt if you have power hammer in one and not in another? And then all these considerations they have to take when they're developing and designing their class that they want to teach. And then there's a ton of research, hands-on research time.
Fall into big savings, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with your card and a digital coupon. Then buy one, get one free on our full line sale of tender Tyson chicken with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Shop for them to work through a bunch of ideas if they want before settling on a certain one to teach. And then once we settle on a certain one, everybody has to present their ideas to the class, receive feedback about them, consider that feedback before making their decision, ultimately make their decision, and then they have time to just focus on that class independently. Whether that's in the class, in the forging classroom, or in the clean classroom, or whatever, and then everybody takes turns teaching their class to one another, and then we critique each other's teaching style and execution.
Being able to talk to all the students who just finished is, like I said, 4 weeks, and I got to speak to everyone. Everyone was very inspired. They were excited. They were enjoyed the class. They were also telling me how nervous they were in between, because, you know, everybody gets a turn in the barrel. You know, everyone in the beginning, you know, you got to teach everybody, and some things go well, some things don't go well. But ultimately, everybody seemed to be very kind of inspired by the opportunities. there.
Yeah, I hope so. You know, I think everybody who applied knew going into it the value of this kind of experience and what this could do for teaching their practice, but also, you know, hopefully the future of educators in the craft. And I think everybody really, you know, had a good takeaway, and it went well, and it's, you know, it's worth us continuing to develop. And yeah, it's 4 weeks, and it's part of our growing long-term educational opportunities at CMA that are scholarship funded, sort of the direction we've been going super, you know, kind of slowly ever since moving to Johnstown. It's part of this kind of like big picture educational program that I think CMA is developing into, stuff like that. So this was the first year doing it. So, you know, in a sense, those students were a little bit like, you know, the guinea pigs or whatever, but it was really good. The only things I think I want to tweak a little bit are the orders of operations in which we have certain discussions versus foraging and stuff like that. So just a little minor like schedule tweaking.
What was it like? Because you became one of the guinea pigs as well. You were one of the students, and as an instructor with a long term, when you were one of the students of these student run classes, how did that feel? Were you looking at it like a student, or were you looking at it like a instructor overseeing the whole thing, or
both? I had to wear a lot of hats here because I had to, you know, to a certain degree, I had to facilitate the workshop that the students are teaching when they're teaching their workshop. I also have to play the role as the student, and then during the critique, I have to critique it from a student perspective and from, you know, I guess a professional educator's perspective. So I had to draw from a lot of, I had to like pretend to be people and actually be people. And I had to like let go of the role that I usually play in the classroom to be the student, and things like that. And so it was really a really rich experience for everyone, myself included. I learned a ton.
Well, we have some questions. Before they all left, I did ask the students of the School is Cool to submit some questions. It'll be okay. Don't worry. And then we also have questions from the listeners' audience. Guys, if you are listening to this podcast and you want to ask Pat a question, go to Full Blast Podcast on Instagram, where you can DM us your questions for the next episode of Great Question with Pat Quinn. And I'm hoping that some of these are great questions. We're going to find out. So the first question, these particular questions are from Pat's students from the School is Cool. The first one comes from a student. His name is Ryan. And the question is, what is a tool or process that you found surprisingly useful or effective? Something that makes you wonder how you could live without it. Is there a particular tool that you found surprisingly effective?
When? Like during this workshop?
No, in general. And I would say in general. You didn't say that's a great question.
Oh, great question, Ryan. I know, because it had me thinking right away. A tool that I found surprisingly what?
Useful or effective. Useful. That you never, that you, once you had it, you wondered why you never how you could have lived without it.
Shit, yeah. I remember having that feeling several times. I'm just not able to currently put
I'll tell you one thing that I recently made that I was just like, man, I got to make more of these, is when I was forging, I've forged 4 integral bolstered chef knives, and I was using inch and an eighth hex bar that I got from Maritime Knife Supply. And what I wanted to do is I wanted to incise where the bolster meets the blade. But I had a guillotine tool, and that was about it. And then I made these very quick fullering tools that I could put under the tire hammer. And it was just 5/16 bar, and I just made like a U, and I held them in some tongs. And I was able to very equally incise that connection between the bolster and the blade. And if I had done it by hand on the guillotine, it would have been a long day at the office, and I'm not a spring chicken anymore. And afterwards, I thought to myself, man, these are so helpful. And then what I wanted to do is I made another fullering tool that I could use, and I was actually inspired by you, what you do, so I could draw down the heel, a handheld bar of, I think it was 5/8, that I could forge down the heel under the power hammer. And I thought to myself, I have got to spend more time refining these tools, because I don't know how I could forge these integral bolsters without it. So that would say that for me, that would be number one and number two.
Thanks for that save, dude. I appreciate it.
I'm with you, dude. I'm with you. You didn't get a chance to see these. But I mean, think about it. You could say anything that you would.
No, I got it. I remembered as you were talking. So
go ahead.
I apologize.
See, that's how we do.
I wasn't paying attention to what you were saying.
That's okay.
It's math. And I remember because it's when you described the question or read the question, sort of described, and I got in touch with what that feeling was like. I knew I had it recently, but I just couldn't put a finger on what it was, but it's definitely math. And it's the one thing that I can pinpoint that I go, how the hell have I functioned for 16 years of forging, maybe 17, before learning how to calculate volume? And so that's the one tool. And that's part of the class, is it's just another tool in your toolbox. Don't be scared. So that's it. It's math.
So if somebody were listening to this and they're saying, well, where do we, I mean, if math is like an ocean of different things, if you were to pinpoint a couple of different areas in math that people should be focusing on, do you have any suggestions for that?
The focus, you know, having learned and become comfortable with the basic calculations to figure out how many cubic inches are in different shapes is what it is. And I think it's mostly algebra, but it of course involves a little bit of geometry because you're dealing with shapes and stuff. Listen to me go. but no, I don't know. I would say find somebody like I did who can make you not scared of it, guide you in a direction, and keep it simple, because it doesn't have to be this overly complicated thing. And then just try to like get to the root of what you're trying to do. Like, you know, sheet metal math or like plotting curves or, you know, creating three-dimensional objects out of sheet metal and where to break them, and that's a different kind of math. I don't really know that, right? So you have to be able to find out what it is you want to learn. But if you're a forger, you simply just need to be able to compare how many cubic inches are in a forging that you want to make and be able to select the starting stock with the same amount of cubic inches. It's like, how else do you start? You have to guess. And then that got real old for me. And then, you know, I'm not going to go into it because I've done it before here, but you can't be guessing in the octagon. You have to know. You can't be wasting everybody's time, energy, and money not knowing you have the right amount of material. And that's what inspired the math. And now I use it even if I'm forging something on 3/4 square bar. Because knowledge is power.
Look at you. Look at you. Well, that's one to grow on. Well, the next question, if somebody was like, all right, well, I want to learn some math, would you suggest, are there books that you would suggest getting? Or would there be something, go to like the local college and take a math class? Or is there something where would you go?
I don't know, man. That path is for their steps alone.
Look at you. All right. There he is, ladies and gentlemen. Next one comes from Angelo. Angelo B. I can't pronounce the last name. Angelo B., I'm with you. Do you feel, this comes from him, from one of your students, do you feel that forge welding is a needed skill to be a well-rounded blacksmith?
Thanks, Angelo. Great question. I don't know, because I don't really do it and I feel pretty well-rounded. But there are instances where I feel like it can be incredibly useful. So it could help. It could help round you out a little more. But it also comes down to what you have available and what your interests are and all that kind of stuff. And because I was raised on power hammers, I think reductively, so I've never really, had the need to forge weld, because I could always draw down and out more efficiently than I can prep and weld and blend. But it also, is like, do you have a coal forge or do you have a gas forge? Are you talking about, because I know Angelo, he's talking about traditional forge welding.
Right.
And so that, is really best done in a coal forge. You're not going to be making chain links or whatever in a gas forge. It just doesn't work that way. And so it all depends on what your interests are. And I always say this too, because life is short and the craft is broad. And so you can't be a master at everything, nor were blacksmiths like back in the day a master at everything. If you made nails, that's all you made. You didn't make nails, dividers, locks, and friggin' files. You just made nails, right? So this idea of forging like we do, where like one day you'll make a hatchet, one day you'll make a hammer, one day you'll make a sculpture, one day you'll forge weld chain link, that's new, right? And so there's so much of that out there that you can't do it all. It doesn't work that way. Life is not long enough and the day is not long enough. So you have to choose your path. And I chose a path that doesn't really forge weld. I'm interested now, and was interested before Angelo taught that forge welding portion of his class during School is Cool. But for me, it's from an efficiency standpoint as I scale up. But no, I don't think you need to be, I think most people, you need to pick what you're interested in and go for it. And certainly can, broaden your horizons a little bit, but you can be a great, well-rounded smith without knowing how to forge weld. But will forge welding help you be more well-rounded? Yeah, for sure.
Great answer. That was a great answer.
Yeah.
Because it also comes from the fact that your direction is sculptural, as opposed to being a cutler or being a forge, colonial blacksmith or a railing guy or all this stuff. So that is the most interesting part, is we have, I think that society or people who are getting interested in blacksmithing have this concept of what they think a well-rounded blacksmith is, like the village blacksmith who is in charge of everything in the village or something like that. And without really, for me, it doesn't, perfect example, as a knife maker, I don't even really refer to myself as a bladesmith. Unless I need it on an article or a resume, I don't really fool around with Damascus at all. And a lot of it's because I feel like I'm not good enough as a bladesmith, and I really prefer to get better at forging in general. So to me, it's like a lot of that stuff, and that's forge welding. It just doesn't. I'm not ready, and I'm not there yet. But I don't feel as though it's made me less. Mm-hmm. All right.
I mean, there's also electric welders, torch welders, TIG welders. Like, forging is not what it was. And if you want to do anything more with it than have it be a hobby, very few people can use the forge welding process, in my opinion, to make a lucrative life out of that. I guess it all depends, but you might find yourself in a situation where you have to change your mindset or forging methodology away from that traditional craft because of current trends in economics and stuff like that.
Here's a question that's kind of slightly foolish, but I think maybe it's not, or maybe it might be a great question or might not be a question. This is our friend Ian. Ian's a great dude. He said, define a wingus. What is a wingus?
As I know it, a wingus is that area in between two shoulders that don't line up.
Two shoulders that don't line up.
Like, for instance, if you're setting a shoulder or doing a butcher on two sides of a bar that are 90, well, they're not opposite, they're next to each other.
Okay.
And you want those shoulders to be in the same place.
Okay.
Right? So you have this really beautiful transition. And let's say if it's a 1-inch square bar, you have a 1/2-inch square tendon coming off the corner of the bar.
So okay.
That's what I mean by the surfaces. And then you set both of your shoulders, but you miss the spot you're supposed to set it in one. So they don't quite line up. So there's an awkward spot in the corner of the bar where your transitions don't line up.
Okay.
That's the Wingus.
There will be a picture on Full Blast Podcast on Instagram. I will get a picture of a Wingus, and then we will submit it as a visual example.
I think we have to make sure that's the true definition first, because there was some debate over this the other night.
Well, I think that you're the final answer, in my opinion.
You know, you've got to also review the people.
Okay.
What the people think.
That's fair. Right. Right, we'll give a submission for what a potential Wingus is.
We will.
Okay.
We will.
Next question comes from Beatrice. Beatrice, you had a nice student, Beatrice, from Arizona. She, by the way, of France, and she had a lot of questions. And I'm going to do one at a time. What are the basic tools you need in a blacksmith shop?
A hammer, an anvil, a vise, tongs, and an oxy-fuel torch, and a forge.
Okay.
Or furnace.
Okay. And then you build everything from there.
Yeah, I mean, if you had a table, that'd be cool.
Yeah, that would be cool. Table would be cool. All right, the next question she asked was, how hot should your metal be when you forge it? These are very basic questions, but I think they're good.
As hot as it can be.
Do you have
before a... Before it melts?
That was a question we had in the friction folder class was... the difference between mild steel and mild steel and carbon steel. And when we were forging our friction folders, especially towards the end of the forging, I was telling everybody, don't put it in the forge and walk away. And there's your gas forges, so there's no chance of it melting. But every single time you put the carbon steel in the forge and then there's scale, that scale represents the carbon that you're losing in your knife. So I was constantly telling these guys, and usually you say that in general, like when you're at teaching a forging class, don't put the material in the forge and walk away. I was very, very conscientious with all these guys that we can get it hot enough to move it, but we don't want it to get there's no reason to get it to yellow heat. I guess the answer is it just depends on what you're doing.
Yeah, the answer is get it as hot as you can get it and work it as few heats as you can work it to get the shape that you want.
What I liked in the last episode we were talking about is when we were talking about one of the things that resonated with me and a lot of other listeners was we were talking about scale. And we were talking about how people brush scale and how you've changed your philosophy in regards to how often you use the wire brush to remove scale before you forge, and you were saying you've kind of stopped doing that. That was a really interesting, I don't know where I was going with that, but that was a really interesting point in regards to forging at lower temperatures too.
Yeah, I mean, that's how you know, if you're concerned with surface, that's definitely a way to clean it. Like, cleaning your work after you forge it is something I like to do, something I like to teach, and there's various ways you can do it after the forging is over. But if you want to make your life as easy as possible, you'll finish your forging with as little fire scale on it as possible.
I'm going to ask one more question from Beatrice.
Okay.
Because the last question is a little bit crazy. And you know what? Maybe if it's crazy, it's okay. What are the 5 steps to follow when making a hammer?
5 steps to follow.
What are the 5 steps to follow to make a hammer?
There's 5?
She's your student. I don't know. I mean, I don't know where she got it. I thought there were more than 5.
Maybe there's only 1.
Ooh. Make me one with everything.
So should I choose 5 things?
I guess you could pare it down.
Okay. Pay attention to everything.
Okay.
Everything. But get it hot when you're doing it. Make sure everything is exactly where you want it to be before you engage any sort of tool or equipment. Is that 3? That's 3, right?
Yes, 3.
That's 3. Exercise safety. So, you know, if you're doing stuff on the hammer, make sure you're plumb, level, square, all that kind of stuff. You know, make sure your tools are safely dressed. Make sure if you're using tong-held tooling under the hammer, like punches, things like that, you have a good grip on them with the tong clips. Make sure you have water around to keep your tools cool. And then, you know, I would say after the forging is over, if it's made out of alloy steel that you're going to heat treat, I would anneal it first so that you can have a more successful heat treat and an easier time doing the finishing. And then a hammer is only as good as the handle you put it on.
Nice.
So you could have the best forged hammer in the world, but if it's on a shitty handle, it's a shitty hammer.
Fucking good.
So don't go crazy with your handles, folks.
Wow. Dig it. And then, you know what? Let's give Beatrice the benefit of the doubt. The last question from Beatrice is, why do blacksmiths have so many tools? No, because you're always, I would imagine, I mean, what do you think?
Because we can't touch the material.
I would think it's a lot of it. I think that ultimately it comes from a place of, I think if you were to think about it deep down, I think ultimately it comes from a place of wanting to be better every day and thinking maybe having that tool will put you in a better position to succeed. Is it possible?
Possible. Can I go on this?
Please,
minute?
Do it.
All right. So I think it has a lot to do with the process, with the heat, and with the material itself being a material that is soft but also hard. So you need impact for it to work, right? So you can't push a fuller into a piece of metal and then drag it sideways and move the metal, right?
Right.
Which you could do if you put that fuller in clay, for instance, right? So you have to think about the mark that you're making in the steel from a downward perspective, but also from a sideways perspective. And you have to think about how you're going to achieve certain shapes when you sink down into it. And then what's that metal going to do from side to side as well when you put downward pressure on it? So it's going to squish. It needs to go somewhere. And if you really want to control where it goes, you need like all these different shapes to do all these different things. And because, and I'm relating it to ceramics, but like if you had a 1-inch square piece of ceramic that was 8 inches long, you could do a lot with your thumb. You could put a sharp thing into it, turn your thumb on the side, and then you could move it to pack a nice shoulder, and then you could drag this material all the way over. But we can't do that. So we need all these different shapes that can impact and steer the material. And if you want to do a variety of different shapes and things like that, then you need a variety of different tools. And then, of course, because we're the tool makers of the craft world, I think we become a little bit obsessed with it.
That's a great answer.
Yeah. I mean, it's got to be. It's like you can do a lot with one chisel if you can do things that aren't just downward. But we can only really go downward. And then, so then what? I don't know.
No, but I mean that's that's kind of similar. I mean, what I like to refer to it from a job standpoint in regards to, I was talking about my daughter a couple of weeks ago, and I was saying that she had a summer job and they gave her the tools to succeed. And that was it was not the literal tools, but they gave her all the things that she needed in order to succeed. And I feel as though if you're provided with the concept of the tools that you have the ability to succeed in the direction that you're going. That's good. Beatrice did a nice job. I like Beatrice.
Yeah, totally.
Last question is a two-parter, but I'm not going to read the first part because
this one here.
Yeah. Oh, do you want the first part first or the first part second?
Well, I don't know. I just peeked at that.
Oh, all right. So the first part is this. I think this. Is Cole Pie? Is that Haley?
Cole Pile?
Is that Haley? Okay. Or B.B. Smith? I don't know what that is. All right. Never mind. If you were a breed of dog, what would you be and why?
I'd be a cat, and I'd be an outdoor cat.
Really? Like the ones you're saving all the time?
No, I wouldn't want to live this close to Iron Street.
Right.
Yeah.
You'd be a cat.
I'd like to be a cat that had like a lot of woodland access.
Your cat saving is unbelievable. How many cats have you rescued?
Seven.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
That's unbelievable.
I know a cat's not a dog, but I don't know a lot about dogs. But I would say right now I'm kind of obsessed with Australian Shepherds.
They're pretty slick.
Yeah.
All right. Next question. I'm not answering it because I've had it with my dogs, frankly.
I mean, I'd want to be like a cross between I like the energy level of a bulldog.
Yeah.
You know, but I'm not really into like how gross they could be.
Yeah, that's a good answer. That's for you, Haley. Next question from Haley is, what is something you wish you knew as a young blacksmith?
You know, this is so hard because I haven't been able to consider these, so I feel really on the spot.
That's good.
It's not good for the listener, though.
I don't think. You know what? Let me start in. The funny thing is it's taken me a long time to be comfortable with my age. And I talk about it all the time. I think I talk about it all the time only because I need to really kind of really put a grasp on the fact that I'm not a young man anymore, 50. And I would not change a thing in how, if I could talk to myself as a younger person, I don't think I'd make any changes because I would never have gotten to this position that I'm in now otherwise. I think that if I was to tell myself as a younger blacksmith, I would have been like, pay a little bit more attention or care a little bit more.
About what?
I was very blasé when I was younger. I was very blasé about everything. And I think a lot of it had to do with my own spite. I think I was I was fueled with spite. And I was cavalier, and I wasn't reverential towards things or processes or techniques, and a lot of that came from my father. But at the same time, I think that I had a chip on my shoulder, and I think I would probably tell my younger self as a blacksmith to just to listen and don't be such an arrogant guy. Mm-hmm. I don't really have much more than that.
What was the question again?
What is something you wish you knew as a younger blacksmith?
Dude, you know, because I can't, where my mind immediately goes is to like, what do I want to tell young blacksmiths? Like, that might help them. But that's not really the question. The question is, what do I wish I knew as a young blacksmith? And I'm just so like happy with the path that my career has taken that, you know, it's hard for me to like wish something different, you know. But I think like it always comes down to safety for me, honestly, like, you know, how important hearing protection is or a respiratory protection. And those are things that I didn't care, not because they like weren't cool or something, but you know, when you're young, you know, physically you feel invincible, so you don't feel like you need to do those things. And then, you know, when you're older, they come back to bite you. So like I have, you know, tinnitus, so like constant ringing in my ears, which sucks. You can hear me coughing. I have asthma, and I think it's because I've sanded so much without respirators, you know, and that aluminum oxide and ceramic dust you breathe in, you know, who knows, but, you know, it's all about that. But also, like, you know, just being conscious of, like, big picture shit, right? Because when you're young, you're also, like, pretty involved in, like, your path and your life and how that relates to forging and different shops and stuff like that. And so, you know, one thing I always think about is like, you know, in relationship to like myself and CMA and what it takes to run this place, and a lot of folks, like, you know, I see a disconnect between like what we're doing and what it takes to do it from the back end standpoint, you know, and I didn't know that when I was younger either, but I had to learn that sort of the hard way. But just kind of like, you know, big picture, materials, fuels, you know, budgets, you know, when I was young and would go to shops and things like that, like having people in the shop is something that like, you know, cost somebody money, and I didn't realize that. And I'm like, oh, can I do this? Can I do that? Like all this kind of stuff. But, just the amount of kind of, resources it takes to run and manage a forging shop and a metalworking shop, and what an individual's impact on that is when they're there.
I also think, I guess I would say, it gets better. Say to a young blacksmith, if you keep going, it gets better. The more you learn, the more kind of interested you become, and the more kind of fired up you get.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. This isn't really a question about work ethic either, but I think, you know, it's a lot of like what I think about as well. But does it get better?
It does get better. It does get better. I think that as you age, you know, we talked about this in regards to just hammer size. You know, as I've gotten older, my hammer's size have gotten smaller, and I've been figuring out different ways to be more effective and more efficient based off of my physicality over time. And I felt like that was a real evolution in regards to me as being a blacksmith, you know, or whatever. But, you know, look, it's an interesting thing. Well, you're touching on one thing, and we'll get out of here, is you said, what would I tell young blacksmiths? Why don't we leave it on, what would you tell young blacksmiths?
No, I don't want to do that.
Okay.
Because okay. It's like, I can't, you know what I mean? People, like, you know, that's a question that I would field personally face-to-face with somebody. Maybe that I've known or whatever, but it would all, like, the answer would have to do with, like, you know, work ethic and respect for the community and for the peers and all that kind of stuff. But it's case by case, really.
Case by case. Yeah. Love it.
Yeah.
Well, what's coming on next for the CMA? What are you looking forward to?
This is stuff we talked about earlier, stuff like that. So, you know, I would encourage everybody, hopefully we're doing, we'll be doing some posting. Posting's always hard when you're forging in the octagon, but I imagine that there'll be some stuff, and I hope everybody can see and appreciate and participate and support, and you know, all this cool stuff that I talk about that's happening in the octagon wouldn't be possible without, you know, the help of these. You know, I've got a lot of volunteer help, a lot of in-kind donations, a lot of support from foundations and individuals. And so, like, what it looks like on Instagram and what it sounds like on the podcast is like, well, look at Pat Quinn's doing all this great shit, but the reality of it is none of it would be possible without the greater forging community and all of the supporters who have gotten on board with the hard work we're doing here and are willing to help and you know, not really expect or ask for much in return, because never for money, always for love.
Can't get much better than that, guys. Listen, go follow CMA, Center for Metal Arts, on Instagram. Go follow Hand Forge and VT on Instagram. I will be posting those wherever you're listening to this. And go to the Full Blast Podcast on Instagram, where you can submit questions for the next great question with Pat Quinn. All right, guys. Pat, thank you once again, and we will see you next week.
Thanks.